You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Now, our shapeshifter tonight is Tasnim Fredericks, who is a social entrepreneur, which is very interesting, transformation activist and an advocate for women empowerment, committed to the National Service of South Africa through active civic participation in various formations. She is the former deputy president of the Black Management Forum and is the managing director of Fredericks Incorporated. And she joins us this evening as our shapeshifter for today. It is a conversation I've been looking forward to from the day to day. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Tapelo, and good evening to your listeners.
Thank you so much. No problem. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. I feel a bit exhausted. I actually can't believe how fast the time is going.
Hey? Yeah, I see. Has it been a long day?
It's been a long day this whole week.
Sure, I know, right? So you can't wait for tomorrow to end the week.
Yeah, I know. Yes, absolutely. 100%.
Indeed. Well, I promise you that we won't weary you, right? We'll keep to the time that has been allocated to us so that you can then go and take a bit of rest. But thank you so much, ma'am, for joining us this evening. We really appreciate it. We've got this segment that we do every Thursday, and this is where we bring people like yourselves who are shapeshifters in different industries, in different spheres of life. You know, it is a conversation for particularly young people who might be looking up to you. Some of them might not even get the opportunity to, you know, talk to you, get to have that in-depth understanding of who you are. How did you even get to be where you are? What has shaped you? What do you stand for? And all those sort of stuff. And this is exactly that platform. So we try and get people like yourselves to talk to us. But before we even delve into our conversation this evening, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What makes you tick? Where were you born? What are some of the things that I suppose as you're growing up, where things that you saw in the community where you lived, and maybe even how they shaped who you are today?
Thank you for having me, like I said. And please, these are the kind of things that actually give me energy, believe it or not. I've been looking forward to this. Yes, absolutely. So as much as it's, exciting for you guys, it's equally exciting, if not more for me. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a small city girl, born and bred in Gqeberha, Eastern Cape. My whole life, grew up in the heyday of apartheid. And I think, that is a marker for me. That's a very important flag that I need to stop and chat about. Mm. Born to very humble parents. My mom, it's the same story for all black people in South Africa during the early 50s, 60s, and 70s. No real future, no real prospects. My mom didn't finish school.
Sure.
My dad was a carpenter.
Sure.
So, we don't come out of politically connected backgrounds.
Yes.
We don't come out of super wealthy backgrounds.
Yes.
My grandmother was forcibly removed in the 50s from an area in Gqeberha called South End.
Mm.
And today, I'm a trustee at the South End Museum, which memorializes forced removals and evictions. And I've had a long journey. I've had a very good run.
Mm.
I'm not saying my run is over, but highlights for me, like you said, I started as a company secretary nationally at the BMF in probably 2010, 2011.
Yeah.
And when I met him, he was Jimmy Manye.
Yeah.
His name's Wanele. I still call him Jimmy when I see him. I still say Jimmy. And I say to him, it's a term of endearment because I know him.
Yes.
Jimmy, it's not an insult. I'm not colonizing his name. In any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So I think, having grown up during apartheid and being very actively aware during my time in high school with SRC leaders, with this robust conversation around liberation, we had walkouts. It wasn't the best education.
Yes.
But there was a deep sense of community. So I lived in a colored township.
Yeah.
And, or the northern areas, as people from Kabega could refer to, you know, the colored township. So I was, I had not had any engagements. When I speak to students, BMX student chapter, and I talk about, where I come from, one of the things I say to them is, two things happened to me in 1996 when I went to the then University of Port Elizabeth. Yes. I met white people for the first time, and I met a computer for the first time.
Those are
two things that stand out for me in 1996 when I, I think my story is very similar to many black people my age, black professionals. I took two taxis to get to university. I'm Muslim, so there was no, we talk about diversity and inclusion a lot in corporate, in daily life, etc. And a big thing is made of it, and rightfully so. We are very different, and we must acknowledge these differences. But I come from a time where, there was, societally, women had a place and it was in the kitchen. Men had a role and it was at the head of the table as the provider. And so for me, being a Muslim growing up, there was no real mentors or people who looked like me that I could, ask for guidance. I looked to my parents, honestly, and I looked to my grandparents. And I think, thankfully and gratefully, I'm super blessed to have had that guidance. Without that formal label of mentor, mentee like we have today.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Sure. That's amazing. That's amazing.
That's amazing. I want to say one last thing about me. Because I'd be remiss if I didn't say that. I often make a note to say it. I say, if I were to measure my greatest achievement, okay, if there was one thing that I want people to remember about me, it's that I am a proud mother of a 15-and-a-half-year-old daughter. He's my greatest achievement. If I was successful in nothing other than being a good mother, then I would die happy.
Certainly. That's beautiful. I was going to say that I've been to Kobeha, I think, once or twice. It was with the new name, changing the name to Kobeha and all that, which was different in itself. It seems like there's an atmosphere that's been created by the change. Do you get the sense as well?
I like it. I mean, for me, we really... It's not the most important thing to happen in a country where we have bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
But I think we need to celebrate these milestones where we start to undress this white cloak that was forced upon us. I think there's a lot of excitement around and people have accepted it. Initially, obviously, with everything that changes, there's resistance. People are not sure how to process.
Yeah.
What does it even mean?
Yeah.
But if we can learn to say vereniging, then we can learn to say kabeh.
Indeed. Indeed. Okay, that's amazing. Now, you spoke about, for instance, growing up, in a family that's not necessarily rich or coming from privilege and all that. And I'm asking this question because, there could be other young people, particularly black young people, who are also living in such conditions where, there's just, lack around them. And it can be easy for them to, give up and not really see a future because of the circumstances that surround them. Was that proliferated within PE at the time? And what made you not to give up?
Tapelo, I think for me, and it's not, it's not the same place today, but we grew up as a community, apartheid, I don't want to use the words was good because it was bad in everything. It's evil. It was very evil, deliberately evil.
Yeah.
But for me, what apartheid did create was more cohesion amongst black people. So our communities were closer. We had a relationship with our neighbors. We had a relationship with the children who were kids of our neighbors.
Yeah.
We knew every uncle was our uncle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every auntie was our, every grandmother was our grandmother. Yes. So there was that sense of community. And because we were all struggling, because we were all poor in the same, we all walked with shoes whose mouths were clapping when you walked. Yeah. We all squished in our shoes when it rained. We never had cars. Nobody got dropped off at school by the parents.
Yeah.
We walked to school. So I think that for me was, easier But as I grew up and I became more aware, I really, you know, that divide, that economic divide between those who have and those, you know, it becomes more marked. It becomes more emphasized in your mind. And I think for me, you know, when I looked at my counterparts at university, when I met these white people for the first time, I could see now these people are coming to varsity with cars.
Yes,
you know, when they have a break between lectures, they are... They're going to their flats around the corner. You know, they're coming with their prepared lunch and eating well. So everything that supports them to perform was there. You know, and yet when we graduate, we are treated equally, you know, despite. And I think that makes you more, it makes you more tenacious.
Yeah.
It makes you more resilient.
Yeah.
You want to succeed more. You know, I often get asked this question. Again, I love student chapter BMF, you know. They don't invite me enough. And when I say this, they say, ah, Deepi, how can you say that to us?
Yes.
I say, yes, you must have me every day. I've got lots of pearls to share.
Yes.
And I say to them, honestly, from my heart, I answer, and I say, you know what? You know what? What drives me even today, what drives me today is, and what drove me then to succeed despite challenges was, I didn't want to be best friends with poverty.
Yes, no, definitely.
I didn't want to live the life my parents lived. You know, there was nothing wrong. They were happy. But I didn't want to argue about, you know, when, where are we going to get money for rent? Where are we going to get money to pay this? We never went on holidays. You know, and there was one gift a year, and that was when you passed with an A in December.
Yeah.
You came home with your report and you had an A. Not you just passed
32%.
It was like 80 plus.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So the bar was very high. Our parents really demanded of us, and that was a good thing. So, you know, and I know it's difficult. I know in a culture where we are reminded about mental health all the time, I'm very cognizant. I'm very aware of the fact that by the time people come to work, you know, they're already exhausted because they got up 4 o'clock to get to work at 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The environment at home is not the best.
Yeah.
You know, they get beaten, they get abused, and they must come to work with a smile on their face. But unfortunately, you have to come to work with this. You know, you have to show up. You have to, and you must navigate this depression and this, you know, mental health. And I think it's easier said than done. And I don't diminish and reduce the reality of what the majority of people in this country are going through. And despite that, they make it.
Yeah.
Less, we could have more people making it.
Yes.
We could have more people. But I think, you know, what I want to say to young people is, I know what it feels like. I was also young once, maybe long ago, but I still remember.
Yeah.
I was sitting there feeling so lost, you know, feeling like, is somebody coming for me? You know, should I wait? No, nobody must wait for anyone. The people you are looking for, the people that are going to come and rescue you, save you, take you out of this condition. It's yourself. It's you.
Yeah.
It is you.
No one is coming.
No one's coming. It's you that's coming. You have arrived. You are here for you.
That's very true.
I don't know how better to convey that sense of you taking agency and control. Nobody's gonna say.
Yeah.
I guess you pray to God. Through God we can achieve.
Yeah.
But God loves an effort.
Yeah.
God's not gonna help us be lying there on the side of it and we just don't want to get up to anything. So God loves an effort. We must make an effort.
I love that. And I think it's very important for young people. Now, you mentioned the fact that, you know, you got to see, you know, a white person for the first time. But more important, you got to see a computer for the first time. How was your university journey? Because you find that a lot of people will tell you it's a culture shift. It's a mindset shift. You haven't seen this thing before. And so all of a sudden, when you are sitting next to a desk and there's a lecturer in front of you, it can just get so overwhelming. Your university journey, how was it?
Yeah, look, I mean, I had seen white people. It's not like I hadn't seen, but I'm talking about like an engagement with people that you can sit next to and you can actually talk to and that are, you know, because I mean, during apartheid, I mean, there was this conditioning from a primary school level that white was right, you know. White people, you don't look at in their eyes. You must look down because you are lesser than.
Yeah.
We forget those days, you know.
Yeah.
And even amongst black people, and I think this is where the program of separation, because that is what apartheid is, a program of separation, that black people amongst themselves were separated. So we today are not united. We don't stand together. You know, colored people are they in a corner? Indian people don't think that they are black. And African, you know, people are also not amongst African people, there may be some unity, not all, but there, there's not this cohesive triangle amongst, you know. I think the ANC failed us by not, you know, in South Africa, you're either black or you're white, and it should have just been those two instead of maintaining that race classification. But I must tell you that, that for me, I identify strongly as a black person.
Yeah.
You know, wherever I go in the world, I'll say, in my country, in fact, not even in my country, wherever I go, I'm black.
Yeah.
And I'm a proud South African. Yeah. So for me, you know, going to university, coming from a mainly colored background in terms of primaries, of schooling, primary and secondary, and then engaging on a, like an intellectual level at university. You know, I'm jumping around a bit, but I want to say this quickly at this point, at this juncture.
Yeah.
I was very active during the Fees Must Fall in 2015. I was one of the very few sympathetic ears to students when they were arrested, you know, and then when they were put in jail cells and then taken to the criminal section of the court. You know, my colleagues who sat as magistrates said to me, "Oh, Tasneem, I didn't know you do criminal law." I said, "I'm not doing criminal law. These are not criminals." So for me, my journey through university, you know, I was part of Amnesty International. I was part of street law. So we took the constitution into Dansani, for an example.
Yes.
You know, we gave workshops on these Chapter 2 Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
But I want to be honest with you. When we got these rights, we didn't know how to use them.
Sure.
We didn't know what it means.
Sure.
I think even today, they don't know what it means, you know, access to all of these things.
Yes.
And because we didn't know, we didn't use it. So I feel like I fully support the students. It's always been a racist system at university. It's always been a hostile environment, more so for African females than colored or Indian females.
Yeah, yeah.
So I immediately, but I mean, you can imagine, I felt that I wasn't white at university. They still gave lectures in Afrikaans as if, you know, everybody just spoke that, or if they didn't speak it too bad, you've got to learn it. You know, they spoke with a song as if they, and they are the majority. I call them the economic majority.
Yeah.
We are still minority. We're not previously nothing. We historically, disadvantaged.
Yeah.
Because currently we are still, you know, disadvantaged. My daughter, she can't study something that she loves. She must study what's going to make her money,
You
must be independent, stand on your own two feet, get a good job, do it well, earn money. You know, we've got that. Whereas I can see white people when they raise their kids, and these white kids are so confident. You know, they're confident. They can own their space. They speak out. Even if they don't know if what they're saying is true or not true, they speak. And I feel like we need to teach our kids confidence. The youth must be taught, you know, believe in yourself.
Yeah.
Believe in yourself. Because what saved me, and my father, you know, God bless him, he's not here anymore, but he, from a young age, instilled such a sense of confidence in me. He never made me feel like I was lesser because I was a girl.
Yes, yes.
In fact, I think he treated me better than he treated, you know, my brothers.
Yeah.
He really elevated me, and that was important to me because that made me feel like I was equal to any man, if not better.
Yes.
If not, imagine, coming out of apartheid and thinking that you are better than a man, even because you have no limitations in your mind. Your father told you can be, you can do anything.
Yes.
And so I grew up believing in myself.
Yes.
And so going to institutions of higher learning where that racism, they don't cater for you in terms of food, they don't cater for you in terms of culture, you do feel isolated. It's a horrible thing. And so when the students were being arrested for Fees Must Fall, I felt as that student in 1996, I'd failed them.
Yeah.
Why are they doing this now? Why are they being forced to experience racism when I was supposed to be that generation that, you know, paved the way, that made sure that this racism will not be perpetuated? But, you know, of course, these things don't. It may, I mean, imperialism is 600 years old. Apartheid itself is preceded by colonialism. So we can't reduce it to, you know, people say, and I hate this, Tapila, I want to say this to you. We are apartheid survivors.
Yeah.
You know, like you get Holocaust survivors in every single city and town over the world. There's a museum on the Holocaust. It's like Jewish people have the monopoly on pain.
Yeah.
Nobody else is allowed to have pain like the Jews.
Sure.
So I'm saying we are apartheid survivors. And we have not received reparation like the Jews have received from Germany.
Sure.
The Jews were paid for the Holocaust. I'm not diminishing the Holocaust. It's a terrible, you know, it was a genocide. It was terrible. It's something that we must continuously remind ourselves of. We don't want a repetition.
Definitely.
We don't want a repetition of apartheid. Definitely. We equally don't want a repetition of apartheid. And we don't want to be told as black people, yeah, it's been 28 years, 29 years, 30 years. Can you just forget now?
Yes.
Can you just leave this apartheid thing alone now?
Yeah.
The ANC must be blamed for your own government. Black people oppress black people. Don't talk about apartheid. You know, just forget that, because we all know the TRC was a scam. You know, this whole thing was just a negotiated mess. We accept that, because I think, you know, this economic majority would have probably done what they did in Rwanda. They'd have just wiped us out. So I think the powers that be had much power really to bargain much. I often think about it, you know, was this the best? Was this the best they could do at the time? And then I have to believe it is. I have to believe people didn't die for nothing.
I'm with you there. Law. Let's talk about law. What drew you to law? Did you always want to do law?
I think that, you know, being in the students' SRC, Representative Council at school, you know, that gave me, and growing up during apartheid, you know, that sense of justice and that sense of what's happening. Yeah, I can't completely articulate and convey to you, but I know it's wrong. You know, I remember, you know, stupid things. I mean, I remember going to town and seeing this kind of, you know, restaurant over what used to be called a Main Street. It's now Govan Bakery Avenue. And I see these people. I don't say I see white people or black people or brown.
Yeah.
I just say, Mommy, I'm 7 years old. I say, Mommy, I see this, you know, I see these people. Can we go there? You know, can you take me there? I want to go for ice cream. And my mom telling me, no, it's closed. And I'm saying, how can it be closed every time? But there are people walking there. You know, she obviously could not explain to me that I can't go.
Yeah.
And I do remember one incident where we went to, like, I think it was Van Staden, some beach resort place.
Yeah.
And being stopped at the gate, and I think my dad borrowed a car and we decided we're going to the beach. And we went to this one place and a beautiful, you know, sand dunes. But there was a gate and my father driving up and the security guard coming out. And saying to us, no, you know, we can't go in because we're not white. But then, you know, kind of like poked his head in the car and he looks at my mom and he says, but she can go in, she looks white. what are we supposed to do, Tapela, while my mom's sunbathing and swimming over there with a watermelon?
Yes.
You know? And we stand at the fence and watch. So, I mean, I think those things, I'm 46 years old. Those things, I can remember. I have memories of that, you know, growing up. Basically, you know, my grandmother telling us stories how people, you know, white people, Chinese people, African people, Indian people, Malay people, colored people, all lived in harmony in South End. It was such a diversely, culturally, you know, religiously rich kind of community. Everybody lived. Nobody said, oh, but, you know, you're a little bit too black and you're a little bit too this and you're a little bit too white and you've got blue eyes. And no, people really lived together. And that was disrupted with the Group Areas Act.
Yes.
And of course, my mother's of mixed race. And when my dad and her dated, my mom, you know, my mom would tell the story about how the police would follow them, you know, and want to arrest my dad because why is he dating someone that's, because my dad was, you know, my dad was very brown, he was dark brown, he had this beautiful skin.
Yeah.
But my mom's like, you know, fear of company. So they used to be followed, and because they thought that my dad was now, you know, busy with some white woman.
Yes.
So things like that. I mean, in the greater scheme, I know people underwent worse, but I mean, this is my lived experience. You know, this is why I thought to myself, no, man, this thing is not right. I need to do something that's going to be. And he, you know, started in studying law. I started off in psychology.
Okay.
And again, Tapela, this is so stupid because I remember the social work lecturer coming into class and saying to us, because I was doing BA psych, and saying to us, you know, if you want to be a social worker, just remember the money's not good, but, you know, it's a caring job. And I thought, if this, honestly, because I'm not here to be caring, I'm here to make money. So I immediately left that. I was like, I'm not studying psychology with no money. I don't know why. I thought lawyers make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's what drove me. Other than, you know, and once I embarked on law, it was the perfect fit.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of knew this is where I was going to end up in, even though initially, you know, and then it cemented my views on, you know, social justice, on transformation, on woman empowerment, on just advancing a strong black middle class.
Yeah.
You know, I think ultimately that is what we must strive for.
Sure. That's amazing. Now, let's tell us a little bit about Black Management Forum, right? And for people who follow it, and for some of us who are in the ESD space, you know, type of a thing, this is a prestige organization, right? And I know our thought leader is also involved, or was involved at some stage, Monday and Love. Where do you see BMF going?
I think, you know, I don't really want to say where do I see BMF. I can answer to BMF, but I think there are many. I served in many other organizations. I served in the Black Conveyancers Association, which speaks to conveyancers, you know, black professionals that are doing, specifically specializing in property law, which is what I do day to day. And I think all black organizations, maybe even where are we going? You know, it's a very tough question, because this fight has been such a long, exhausting fight for transformation.
I'm sure.
And it feels to me like organizations are kind of, they've kind of peaked. We're flatlining at the moment.
Oh,
you know?
That's sad.
It's very sad, but we're flatlining. I don't want to say we're regressing, because that's like taking hope out of the picture. You know, I want to say we're flatlining, because that means stagnation is better than regression.
Yeah.
But if we look at the state of the country, you know, economically, because that is what, you know, you can have all of these rights, and we do. We have all these beautiful rights enshrined in all kinds of documents from way before the Constitution. I mean, we've got this Freedom Charter, all of these nice, you know, nice to have when you have an ideological debate, you know, and you talk about, you know, black, you know, kind of advancement and upward mobility for black professionals and strong middle class and, you know, prosperity for black people. It's all good and well in mouth. So we can have these leaders that are actually talking. It's easy to talk transformation. Someone can write, you know, ChatGPT can write my speech.
Definitely,
for me. My speech on, you know.
Yeah.
And then and what I find is, like, ministers, you know, I'm not sure why a minister of labor would, or an MEC of finance would stand in a public engagement and say something like, you know, from 44% unemployment, we're now on 42%, and people stand and clap. He gets a standing ovation after his speech. It's disgusting. It's tragic. You know, so for me, black organizations are only as strong as, you know, the clout, the influence that they have. And I don't know if we don't have support with government, because government really, they have failed us. You know, I'm not anti any party, anti any. I'm just saying, as an ordinary South African, you know, this country is really not giving me a sense of, I'm not going anywhere, Tapelo. There's not many places I can go with a green passport. I don't have whatever. I don't have links to. You know, I probably can't even go to Russia, where nobody wants to go with my passport.
Definitely not.
You know, so I'm not going anywhere. You know, so if this is the Titanic that I must die in, then this is going to be my Titanic. I don't want to be this. I don't want to be on a sinking anything. But, you know, for me, it's important. What is the, because these conversations that you and I are having tonight, I don't want my grandchildren to be speaking about the black struggle, you know, black professionals that they have now done, you know, which is a huge, major feat, having gone through, you know, challenges that we go through then and now, to be having a conversation around, you know, access to capital, the fact that, you know, black people are redlined, you can't buy in certain areas. And I see it, the banks will not give loans to houses in the township. You know, banks move out of townships. They move out. When I say townships, I mean colored townships. You know, African, every township that you can get, because the measure there is poverty. And the face of poverty in this country is largely black.
I suppose I was asking this question because, I mean, we do think that these organizations and structures are very important to, I suppose, champion transformation and, you know, the plight of the marginalized and those that have been affected. And as someone who has been on the inside and, you know, having worked in there, you know, obviously there is some insights on how the rest of us can support such organizations as well. Because there is this thing that says, I'm not part of the PMF, so I'm not going to be involved, as if you are not affected, when in fact you are affected by transformation that's not going anywhere, you know, in this country. And you try and then push and push, but you're almost hitting always against the wall. And so we do see such organizations as very, very important. And I think that's the frame of that question. But I want to get to the questions around Fredericks Incorporated. What do you guys do there? And what was the reason for starting it?
So basically, what do we do at Fredericks Incorporated? Can I just say something about the previous question, because you've reframed it for me? Can I just do
that?
Yeah,
no problem.
I just want to say that please join the BMF, please join the BCA, please join whatever black professional organizations there are, because we need protection.
Yes.
We still need protection. Yeah. It's unfortunate, but we do need protection. We need solidarity.
Yeah.
We need unity.
Yeah.
BMF has worked on the Procurement Act. We've given birth to triple PFMA. We've given birth to the minimum. The labor law, I sat on NEDLAC, and we made input to the minister on national minimum wage, and there was huge resistance by corporate South Africa white people. When I say corporate South Africa, I'm talking about, they were scared investment were going to leave. So people operate in the scarcity mindset and this whole thing of fear. But we had national minimum wage implemented. Nobody left the country because labor is still so cheap.
Yeah.
So BMF is very important. All I was trying to say is we need support of our members, so people must join. We need support of government, so we need to put them under pressure. And we do need support of business. They must be made to feel bad about being able to get away with apartheid.
Mm.
So I'm closing that question. I just wanted to make that.
Definitely. I mean, just before you even go there, we had Prof. Mohale last year, and he was echoing the same thing as well, to say we need to stand behind such organizations. And I think that's our view as well.
Wonderful. It's not a surprise to me, because I serve as the company secretary to Ntate Mohale, so I'm very grateful to have, you know, known him on a personal level and to know him.
Yeah.
And that wisdom is from him. So I can speak in that voice, because it's, you know, we speak the same language in the BMF. I think I just sometimes feel a bit hopeless, but we can't give up hope. We must join BMF. We must
Sure. Okay, Fredericks, as we draw to a close.
As we draw to a close, Fredericks Incorporated, so our firm deals with normal, you know, we are specialized, we are boutique, we deal in property law, so transfers, bond registration. I'm one of the very few, myself and a colleague of mine, Pumeza Borno Buja. There aren't many black law firms that are on all the bank's panels, and because it's so difficult to meet the criteria, and it's so difficult, because you can get on the panel, but then not get work.
Yeah.
And you can get on the panel and get kicked off the panel tomorrow, because they've got very, you know, very high standards. And basically we're operating on the same level as I would say, like an international law firm, let's say Bowman's, or, you know, their conveyancing department. I often get, you know, when I must link with other attorneys, like international law, big law firms in the Eastern Cape, you know, I feel like I do a better job than what people think big law firms are supposed to do.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So I mean, I don't like the word black excellence.
Yeah.
Simply because it implies that black people are generally not of excellence, because nobody ever speaks about white excellence. I've never heard a white excellence awards. Yeah. Never attended one in my life. Never. Never. And you have to ask yourself why, because white people really, the assumption is white people are excellent.
Sure.
But what I do want to say is, as black people, we do have to work three times harder. In fact, three times is an underestimation. Probably, I remember in a meeting with the then deputy president, now President Cyril Ramaphosa, I mean, he said to us, you know, as black people, and I thought it was very unfair. He said, as black people, you know, black professionals, you guys need to be on top. You need to work like 100 times harder. And I thought to myself, you know, why are these conversations not being had with white people? As if, but it doesn't matter, because we know what we need to do to get to the top and stay on top. And this is the you know, raw reality of the situation. That is the next one thing. Yeah, but white people are not. White people are prospering. We are not. We need to do what we need to do to prosper. So yeah, we do conveyancing. We do a little bit of commercial work. I'm on the development zones panel, so we look at the notarial leases, so all notarial work, antenuptial contracts. Sabila, I don't know if you're married. I don't know if it's politically correct to ask you that, but if you ever need an antenuptial contract, I'm here, my brother. I can help you.
Yeah, you're going your direction, definitely.
I'm a notary public, and it's a very boutique law firm specializing mainly in property law, commercial law, and then we obviously also do wills and administration of deceased estates.
I see. That's beautiful. Okay. Here's a question I've been wanting to ask. Your relationship with money. How do you characterize it?
You know, it's a very difficult one because for me, I know what it is to be poor. So I'm not afraid to lose money, right?
Okay.
I don't want to ever be poor, so I do work. I try to manage my affairs in a very good way. And I never feel like pressure into acquiring assets for the sake of showing my neighbors, I'm driving this budget. For me, I feel like, you know, you can't store all of it. You've got to, if you have the kind of money that will give you access to experiences, to other environments, then you need to use your money in that way. So money for me is a tool, you know. It's a means to an end. It's not the end. I think, you know, if you like investments, for me, I'm more about, you know, earning money, putting it in a safe place. I'm not very ambitious and very adventurous with spending money, but for me, it's important.
Yeah,
it's important to me because what can I do with money? What can I do with money? What does money give me access to?
Yes.
So I'm not going to keep money in a bank account because I want to see my balance accrue.
Yeah.
So that's my, and is it going to also, I need to experience some joy in this world.
Yes, definitely.
So yeah.
Okay, that's lovely. And what is the one mistake that you've done with money?
Borrowed money to friends and family.
Okay.
That I didn't have to lend out because I never got it back.
I mean, family especially. Eh?
Yeah, no, definitely. That's the mistake. I mean, I invested in some properties and, you know, it was around 2007 when the bubble burst. So I lost money there. But I don't think it's mistakes. You know, I think the harder we fail, the quicker we learn, the more successful we become. Because, I wouldn't consider anything I did with money as a mistake. You know, I don't waste money, but I do. I spend. You know, I don't have this scarcity mindset. I'm quite comfortable to use it for.
Fantastic. And as we end, what would you say to your younger self? What would you do differently?
You know, in our religion, I'm Muslim, so in our religion, we believe in destiny, tawakkul. You know, that God has. When you're born, your date of birth, in fact, when you're born, your date of death is already written down. So there's not much you can do around changing that date. But I think for me, I think just this concept that we now learn, you know, this healing journey, because we are so critical of ourselves. I want to say to my younger self, you know, the 7-year-old or the 9-year-old, Tasneem, I want to say to her, I love you. You've done so well. I'm super proud of you. You rock, girl. You know, you rock.
Definitely.
So, that's what I'd say.
Definitely. And what would you do differently?
Again, you know, I think that everything I've done, it may not have always been deliberate, but there's nothing that I would have done differently. Honestly, I have no regrets. I enjoy every experience, good, bad, ugly. I'm accepting of that.
Yeah. Sure. That's amazing. And finally, I think it has been a pleasure talking to you. Young people listening right now, and I think some looking up to you as well, what would be your one message? I suppose one message of encouragement. I know that some young people who are doing their grade 12s are also preparing to write final exams and all that. What would be your message to all of them?
I think, you know, for me, it's just to say that believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. And whatever you are going through, know that it will pass. Know that if there is nothing in this world that is meant for you, that will not come to you.
That's beautiful. Sure.
Yeah.
Anything in this world will come to you. Thank you so much, ma'am. Really appreciate your time. I do think that there is still a lot we haven't, unpacked. And I know that my producers will be in contact with you very soon. But thank you so much for sharing yourself and your journey with us and, some of the work that you are doing as well. And may God continue to be with you and bless you in everything that you do. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Tapelo. I know all of your listeners, there are great things in store for them. And
yes,
we just need to believe that those things, we are capable of doing great.
Definitely.
And we must then continue to do it. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I'll be watching
night.
You as well, Tapelo. I think you're going to be a very big name one.
Ah, look at that.
Even bigger. I'll be watching your face. I will. I promise you.
Definitely. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. Thank you for those. Yeah. Sure. I really needed that. Thank you so much, ma'am. Really appreciate that. Thank you so much. There you go.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.